Anyway.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Good. Are we in media res here? We didn't have the introduction, but anyway, we'll get back to it, right? So that was the position of the Balei HaTos in northern France. And again, because Reb Baruch of Mainz learned with his relative, his teacher, he had a teacher relative, very nice, Reb Eliezer Mimetz, from him he heard this shita, he heard this approach. And look what he says in response. V'ani omer, but I, Reb Baruch says, right, he says, Ba'al korchach l'didei osel l'avus l'havos l'Yisrael b'ribis. D'mihi tirlo. He says, no, I don't think this heter is a good heter. I don't think we should lend or borrow an interest from this apostate. Why not? Because he certainly can't borrow or lend an interest. Why not? In other words, from our perspective, what the Balei HaTos in Northern France is saying is, treat him as a non-Jew. Treat him not as a brother. We'll soften it. All right? Okay, maybe, but it takes two to tango. If we are either borrowing from or lending to this mishumid interest, ribis is an isser where both participants are over. The lender and the borrower are over. If a Jew lends to a Jew, they're both in trouble. One doesn't know, but if they both know what they're doing, they're both in trouble up here. So he says, think of it as very sharp, very nuanced, and very, svara adinah here, really, very, very special svara here. He said, very, very deep. He says that even if we can do it, right, he can't do it. Why? Why can't he do it? I love these words. Demihi tirlo. Who told him it's mutter? Meaning, because what is he? He's really still a Jew. So he's a Jew. It's on paper, osser for him to do it. He can violate the isser, but it's osser. And then he says, v'kevendli d'day osser, since it's osser for him to do this, God warner osser l'halvos l'alavos menem yishum d'lift neiver. We have a responsibility not to cause our fellow Jews to sin. You know, not to allow them easily to sin. So it's very interesting. He says, look at the whole thing the other way around. If you're looking from the Jewish communal perspective at how do we regard a mishumid, how do we regard an apostate, it's a very serious category. Again, it's not the thing you open up a shiur with, but it's very interesting, right? And again, it's somebody who's really observing the other religion, not somebody who's afraid, he's not sure. Somebody, as Reb Lezner said, you know, Shavik Hetera Achal Yisura, somebody who's left Jewish practice, is completely engrossed in that other, in what is tantamount to Avodah Zarah, right? So, yes, if you look at it from the communal perspective, we might be able to get away with saying, what? He's not our brother. But if you look at it from his perspective, he still has the requirement of not lending or borrowing Beribis. And therefore, since it's also to him, what? We can't aid and abet him to do it because we're over with neighbor. Right? That's in this one missing simon. You'd like to know what's in the other 427 simon. Okay. And again, we found other such keta'im. We have a lot of it, not the whole book, but you have a piece here, a piece there. We don't have the book. By the way, where do you find a lot of these pieces? In what we call the Sefer Mordechai. Mordechai ben Hillel, late 13th century, a great melaket, a great collector amongst the Rishonim. He's the one who has a lot of quotes here and there from Reb Baruch. Part of the interesting problem, though, and I have no idea why this is, we can't figure it out, Mishum Ma, either the Mordechai himself or the printers, very often when they mention Reb Baruch, they'll go Reish Beis. They'll do it Reshit Teves. And nobody knows who it is. Rabbeinu Hanan El Reish Ches, we know. No idea. So they dafka take, maybe the printers didn't know. Who is this Reish Beis? We don't know. Who is this Reb? We don't know. Call him the Reish Beis. And so again, there are all these, I wouldn't call them accidents of history, but there are all these little confusions that put this thing into the background. But when you start to put the pieces together, I mentioned this one piece, which is very interesting. We have a ton of pieces. Again, sometimes he's cited by others by name. What's also fascinatingly interesting is this Reb Baruch, who we only recently start to figure out was who he was because of the pieces that colleagues have put together. The Ktzos, one of the great Achronim, Joseph Heller, who died in 1813, the Ktzos knew who this Reb Baruch was. In one place, I found the Ktzos, they don't know everything. There's a complete awareness here. The Ktzos says that this Reb Baruch, he quotes something, again, a piece from a Mordechai that preserves Reb Baruch, and he says, this Reb Baruch here is not the French Reb Baruch in the Tos Sinerchim. Because he knows that this Reb Baruch is a different Reb Baruch. He knows he's like a special Reb Baruch. So there are these glimmers of awareness, but otherwise, out there. Now, do we take this Reb Baruch and replace everything we have? No, and I'll talk at the end of what you do with all this stuff. But we really, you know, begin to feel Chaval al Da'avda, we wish we had it. I'll give you another example. This is sort of a more common example, except in the case of Reb Baruch, as I say, I don't remember how many simanim we've identified already, or how many pieces. I would say it's probably 50, you know, out of 400, at least what's in the section. So that's not bad. You know, we have Hekerut at this, and by the way, again, very large book on lots of topics. And that may have contributed to it getting lost also, besides the pestilence and the floods and the persecutions and the leavings and the expulsions, right? Sefer Torah Shebehechel means mazel. When it comes to lost books, everything has to have mazel. Right? So part of the mazel might have been too big, right? You need a summary. And again, obviously very complicated. Who knows? Right? Tosfos goes with the Gemara. Reb Baruch works with the Gemara, but he's all over the place. You know, this topic, that topic. And again, there's organization, but we don't know. It's basically almost like Beis Din records, right? So you really have to go through the whole thing to really know it. Anyway, here's a sort of a calmer example, but actually an example that we know even less about. Number two, Sefer Arba'a Panim L'Reb Ephraim B'Reb Yitzchak M'Regensburg. Sorry for my scrolling. Right? Reb Ephraim M'Regensburg, again, is a student of Rabbeinu Tam. Right? Reb Baruch is a student, somebody who learned with Rabbeinu Tam, but right, student of Rabbeinu Tam. He's a German. He's from Regensburg, which is in central Germany. He dies in 1175. We know him. He's quoted a lot in Tosfos as Rabbeinu Ephraim, one of my favorites. Right? He's quoted in Tosfos. But he apparently wrote a whole Sefer, of which we know exactly four pieces. And a couple of those pieces are quoted in a Sefer that we happen to have, and that's the Sefer Or Zeruah by Yitzchak and Moshe of Vienna, as I mentioned on the right, that was put together around 1150. Right? Now, interestingly, just to put the history into history, the Or Zeruah is a tremendous treasure trove for these kinds of things. Again, we wouldn't know about this work probably if not for the Or Zeruah. The Or Zeruah was written in the mid-13th century. The Mordechai quotes him, the Trumas Hadeshen quotes him a lot in the 15th century, and then we don't hear from him again. The Sefer Or Zeruah itself was only printed in 1862 in a place called Zhitomir. So it means all the Achronim until 1862 didn't have an Or Zeruah. Again, if you know anything about the Or Zeruah, big book, German book, big book. It goes by topics in Halacha, but it's all over the place. You know, in the best learning sense, it's everywhere at the same time. It's sections, sections, sections. Tremendous. That may be part of the problem, right? It doesn't just fit on a Tosfos. In fact, there's a little bit of a proof that it's a long book, because if you look at the left-hand column here before you read the right-hand, which is Sefer Zeruah, there's a beautiful new edition that was just put out 2 years ago by the Or Etzion Yeshiva in Machon Yerushalayim. And they did a very nice edition. It's much easier to read. They also have on the left-hand side the Piskei or the Simone Maharach Or Zeruah, Chaim Or Zeruah. That's Reb Yitzchak Or Zeruah's son, realized his father's book was very big and people weren't going to stay in for the entire performance. And therefore he gives you what? Short little halachas. Here you don't see it so much because his paragraph is bigger, his paragraph is smaller. There are cases where the Or Zeruah goes on for 2 pages and Reb Chaim breaks it down to 2 paragraphs. So he knew, he realized, my father's book is very big. If I don't make a little, you know, they call it also Piskei Marach Or Zeruah Simane. Some of the people even call it Or Zeruah Katzar, the Or Zeruah Junior. Right? Again, but the Or Zeruah preserves Arba Rashim of Ephraim of Regensburg. Arba Panim, I should say. Arba Panim apparently also is focused in large measure on Dine Mominus. We know that Ephraim of Regensburg was a particular expert there. The Ramban in one place talks about a quintus de garmi, about certain damages, and it seems that that corresponds to something that Ephraim of Regensburg wrote. But again, here's one of the references. This is in Piskei Avodah Zarah Simen Kuf Lamed Ches, right? In the middle of Hilchos Avodah Zarah, which very broad Masechta, let's read, Rabbeinu Ephraim Kasav Ba'arba Panim. So some people get this and go, he had four faces? You know, like which face was he using? No, it's a Sefer Arba Panim. Zeshema Sefer. I mean, I'm just joking, but it's not a joke, because when, you know, what's an Arba Panim? It's the name of the Sefer that we don't know about, right? She'im Sachar Yisrael Bayit Migoy, Asur Yisrael Haniach L'Goy Sheyachnis Elil L'Socha. I don't mean to do all these Jewish, non-Jewish examples, but again, just an interesting example. If a if a, what do you call it, a Jew rents a home from a non-Jew, he can't allow him to leave his avodah zarah in it. In other words, you got to take out, you know, in other words, in a non-Jew's home, you might have an elil, you might have a statue. It's his house. It may not be so easy to move the statue. It has to be moved out. V'cheinim sachar behema v'chimer acharea b'shabes chayiv chatas. Oh, so now the other way. If and here it seems that if a non-Jew rented an animal from a Jew, and the Jew's animal was working, right? The Jew is guilty. In other words, goes both ways. In other words, so the fact that there's a schirus relationship, if a non-Jew buys something from a Jew, who cares what he does with it? It's his. If a Jew buys something from a non-Jew, who cares? You know, it's now his. He does what he's supposed to do. What happens if there's a renter's agreement? So the Rebbe Freim of Regensburg is saying, you are liable if you're Jewish on both sides of the equation. The schirus shela lo kanya. Because we know that even though renting and borrowing, there's a high level of responsibility. So basically, it's almost like in halacha, the renter or the borrower is kind of the owner for a time. You're kind of like the owner for a day or a month or a year. So that if a thing breaks, you got to replace it. If you lose it, you got to replace it, right? So you're like an owner. When an owner loses something, who has to replace it? They do. So replacement is always a sign of ownership. So even though that's true, lo kanya, it's not a complete kinyan. It doesn't mean that you're now throwing the other guy out, right? And you'll say, well, wait a second, right? That's the question. If I rent something from somebody, can they come in? Do I have the key? Do they have the key? So that's what Rebbe Freim says. Whatever the relationship is, it doesn't mean that one has bought it from the other. They're still in sync. And therefore, right, the non-Jew's elil can't be in the Jewish rented place. And the non-Jew, if they rent an animal from a Jew, it has to be rest the Shabbos. Kegon goy mi Yisrael darmi na kati nishli Yisrael beguf ha behema. The schiris lo kanya legamrei. The osir miyasa goy malacha b'shabbos b'behemto. Aval ketzas kanya, meaning there are obviously aspects where it looks like a kinyan, but aspects where it doesn't. Not a terribly controversial halacha, but again, we'd like to see what else is in the book. Right? And of course, interestingly, in the summary of Ma'arach or Zaruah, he actually identifies Rebbe Freim even more explicitly, Rabbeinu Ephraim Rebbe Yitzchak Kosav. Right? Doesn't identify the book, but Kosav, he wrote it. He wrote it in the book. Okay. So he's even earlier than Rebbe Baruch HaMaganser. So this losing German books is happening early. Right? We wish we had it. Okay. One more German example, then I'll give you some French examples. Right? And again, these are all around the same time, the Chaval al Da'avir. Because Rebbe Baruch, as I say, is hardly quoted in our printed Tosas that are mostly French. Rebbe Freim of Regensburg more so because he's a student of Rabbeinu Tam, so we know who he is. The next Chacham also, I don't think he's quoted once in all of Tosas. Tosas Rosh quotes him a couple of times. He, in my opinion, is one of the most important teachers of German Balei HaTosas that we even know. Every one of his students is an all-star. In fact, one of his students was the Or Hazaru himself. And his name in Simin Kuf Lamed Beis, number 3, is Rabbi Simcha Mishpira, Rabbi Simcha of Spire. And he wrote a lost work called Seder Olam. Nothing to do with the Tanaitic history book of Rabbi Yossi Bar Halafta, the Seder Hadaros. No. Seder Olam. Again, a book of order. What does that mean? A Sefer Halacha. It's a good title for a Sefer Halacha. Seder Olam. Here's how the halachic world looks. Here's how your day looks. Yeah. What do you say?
I was just thinking in terms of chronologically why one's called Seder Olam and one's called Seder Olam Rabba, because Seder Olam Rabba, which even though it came first, would seem to imply that it came afterwards.
No, but there's also a Seder Olam Zuta. No, that's because there's also a Seder Olam Zuta. In other words, within that genre, there's another Seder Olam too. This Seder Olam is Minutak Mikol Seder Olam Acher. It was his halacha title. Again, didn't he know there was a Mer? Yeah! That's a medrash. This is a sefer halacha. So, and it's a much different time period. Okay. Now, how do we know this text? So here, again, here's a case where a lot of this does depend on manuscripts. So Rebbe Baruch of Magenz's references in the sefer Mordechai you can find in the Shita Mikubetzis, the Arba Ponim you can find here in the printed sefer Or Zaruah. But part of the way that you go in search of, or that you think about these lost texts, is you find in Kisfei Yad, and we have hundreds of them, from Ashkenaz and Sfarad and other places, wherever you are, and you will, if you look carefully, find names. And again, obviously, if you find it once, it doesn't mean much. If you find it 50 times, it means a lot. That will indicate that this person has been writing books that we don't have. Right? Now, the person who published this, Tshuvotu Psakim, it was published in 1973 by someone named Ephraim Kupfer. Ephraim Kupfer worked for, Olav HaShalom, worked for something called the Institute for Microfilmed Hebrew Manuscripts at the Jewish National Library. They are the keepers of these manuscripts. And this is a Bodleian manuscript. That's what that Bodle thing is. That's Bodleian. That's an Oxford library. In libraries and museums throughout Europe, there were Jewish texts, Hebrew texts that were preserved. Right? The Jews who lived there didn't donate them. They probably left them there. Right? So the Bodleian Library in Oxford has hundreds of Kisvayot. By now, we have a pretty good idea what's in most of them. But in 1973, Kupfer realized that this Bodleian 692 has, again, a bunch of halachic stuff that we find no place else. Texts. We find no place else. So he took about 200 or so that were not known, and he published them. And then, of course, you can start to compare. So in the Siman Kuf Lamed Beis, we have one of about 25 pieces that quote Reb Simcha Mishpira, and again suggest, this piece doesn't talk about his book, but altogether it suggested that he had a sefer. He had a very large sefer from which these pieces were pulled out. So again, a sefer we'd like to get. And this one, Dafka, to spare you, is not about anything having to do with Jews or non-Jews and all of that. This is a simple, Hilchos Brachos kind of a question in a larger way. Tama Hasar. That's how his students called him. Rash, Reb Simcha Mishpira, they called him the Sar. They reversed it. Right? Rash, Sar, right? And you have the same thing. Reb Shimshon Mishantz is called the Rash Mishantz. Reb Shimshon Mikutzi, the uncle of Reb Moshe Mikutzi, is called Hasar Mikutzi. Because there are too many Rashes running around. So here also we have a German reverse. Tama Hasar, Reb Simcha asked. Bebir Kas Avi HaBen, and he asked the following question. He says, what's this bracha of Bris Mila, where the father of the child makes the bracha l'achniso b'riso shel Avram Avinu? Right? That, kind of the mayil, he's basically saying, what kind of bracha is l'achniso? The mayil did the bris, and now I'm making a bracha that the kid is in. It's sort of like pre and post. In fact, it's an interesting question. Normally speaking, procedurally, this is not Machlokes Rishonim, but the way most Ashkenazim do it, the Ram doesn't do it this way exactly because he's a strict constructor of all Birkas HaMitzvahs of before. Amongst Rishonim Ashkenaz, there are many who hold, and that's what we normally do, that when does the father make the bracha? The mayil starts, and he has to do the mila, the chituch, and the priya. He has to remove some skin, put whatever, details now. And the father makes the bracha sort of in between step A and step B. So it started, but it's not finished. So it's almost like a before and after bracha. The mayil makes the bracha, we're commanded to do a bris, and the father makes a bracha. What happened? He's in. He went into the bris. So he says, on that kind of reasoning, lama einu b'varach nami kacha kol mitzvah. Right? So clearly, it seems, why is the father making the bracha dafka and mila? Do we have this bracha? Because normally speaking, the father doesn't do the bris mila. He could, he should, he might. Most of the time, he doesn't. The mayil does it. So it makes sense. You do it, and I announce it. Okay, that's fine. But if that's the case, so what happens? He says, "Lama einu mevarach nami kachal kol mitzvah kakonim echad shachat lo es pischo o asal asukaso." Right? Think about it for a second. Right? Who makes the bracha on shechita most of the time? The shochet. See, he takes it in a pure mitzvah context, the shechita of the korban pesach. Right? Why doesn't the beneficiary say, lachniso Reviso shel korban pesach, whatever the nusach would be, kind of an after bracha, right? And that's typically in regular shechita. Very few people shech to themselves, right? Or asal asukasa. I have no chiyuv to build my own sukkah per se. To come the construction company. It should be a Jewish construction company. What can a non-Jew do? What must a Jew should add something? But at some point, if I'm not doing the mitzvah, so let me at least make, like bris, an after bracha. And of course, there is no such concept, right? Hakanami the Mavarch. The Omar Hasar, he answered his own question. Da filum yirza acher la molo sagele bekach, ula mohel takinu le bracha. In Cain, Bamen, Nikayim, Hod, the Perakamet, the Kiyush, he says, listen, there's no problem having somebody else do the bris, that's fine. Sagile Bekach, right? And there's no problem with the Mael making the bracha. But what's the problem? So the problem is the Gemara in Kiddushin. Ha'av Chayav Lamolo. The Gemara really says, what I said before, you know, I did sleight of hand. The Gemara really says, based on the Pasuk, that the father should do the bris. Because the Pasuk is Vayomol Avraham. Right? It never says anywhere, I must make my own sukkah. Especially if another Jew is doing it for me. I don't have to do anything. Right? I must shech my own behemoth. Not my own korban pesach either. There's no imperative that way. But by meal, there's dafka an imperative. Because the pasuk says, Vayomol Avraham. Right? Ha'av chayel amolo. Me'achid lo mohil, lo sagi delav yihu borich. Oh, so therefore, it's not proper. So it's okay to give the Maisa Mila over to someone else, but it's still your mitzvah to do. And therefore, the bracha is to recognize that the father has a role. And even if his role is to give it over to the Mail, but he's working on it, right? In fact, many Mailim, this is, you know, the kind of huddle that you always hear what's going on in the team huddle, the Mail will say to the father, not just do you make me your shliach, right? But he'll say, really, the father's supposed to do the mila. Want to do it? And the father will go, no, you can do it. Well, good, now make me a shliach. In other words, you know, it's a little comedy, but it's not a serious halachic point there, right? Really, the mitzvah's on the father, right? If somebody goes to shech the behemoth, the shochet says, really, you're supposed to shech it, Mr. Consumer, but I'll do it for you if you'd like. No problem. Therefore, no bracha by the consumer, by the taker there. Yes, bracha by the father here. Again, very sensitive, very interesting. Lumdus, right? You get into a whole lumdus discussion. You think about the way Achronim characterized Birkas HaMitzvah and all that. You go to town with this, but we wouldn't have known it if Kupfer hadn't published it. Right? And so even though a lot of what Reb Simcha does is also the Imamunis, all kinds of Hilchas Ishus, very complicated and detailed cases, there's a lot of nice lumdus and nice Torah here on subjects that everybody would be very happy to see. Okay. Now, Reb Simcha Mishpira, by the way, as I indicated, dies around 1230 CE. So just to go in order here, Reb Ephraim of Regensburg, Arba Panim, don't got it. Reb Baruch of Magenza, Sefer HaChochma, don't got it. Reb Simcha Mishpira, Seder Olam, don't got it. Except we have pieces. Right? And they tell us, the pieces that we have, tell us a lot about the authors, tell us a lot about their learning, and generally tell us that wouldst we could have this, we'd probably be better off. But we don't. Again, in this particular case of Reb Simcha Mishpira, Kupfer helped us by publishing the manuscript. So in other words, in some cases, with these lost Sfarim, the chances of finding them are slim. We have remnants, because otherwise we would know about them, but the chance of finding the whole thing or more are slim. In some cases, we can either hope that more manuscripts will be dug up. Sometimes what happens with these manuscripts is people don't know what's in them until they go through them very, very carefully. You know, a lot of it they seem to know. There are parts they didn't go through. So we can yet, you know, you see, you may see in the library, a Tosfos to this Masechta, another version, was in a manuscript, you know, till very, very recently. So there is some way to reclaim some of these. Okay, so that's as far as these first few. Now, let me show you a different type of quote-unquote missing work. And I've Dafka picked two French examples, so nobody should think it's only a German problem. Although, as I say, these big German Sfarim, they were in for a bruising. You know, they took a licking and they didn't quite keep on ticking. In other words, it's the chavak. And then we'll talk about what to do with all this stuff. Okay. So in source number four, we know we have from a number of Balei HaTosfos, actually especially some French Balei HaTosfos, not just in the 13th century Dafka, we'll move a little later, not just their Sfarim, but also their Psakim. Their halachas, you know, psak means not a full tshuva, short piskei halach, for example. They've already published a couple of different versions of Piskei Rabbi Yechiel miParis. Rabbi Yechiel of Paris is best known, probably, for his role defending the Gemara at the time of its trial in 1240 in Paris, right? Ended up, unfortunately, being burned, but he did the best he could, right? Kind of a fix. But we have from Piskei Rabbi Yechiel miParis. What we didn't know until recently was he also wrote Tosfos Arvei Psachim. We have little pieces of those now, too. So again, things are always, by the way, these Germans, I won't even talk about it now, they wrote Tosfos, too. Some of which are in manuscript, some of which are cited. some of which never made it out. Rav Moshe Taku, who was the Rav of Regensburg, he wrote Tosa and Darim, never made it out of Regensburg. They're quoted by people in Regensburg, gone. So that's a whole other subject. But for these Frenchmen, we have these psakim. Rav Yechiel, you have a whole, a book. We also have them by Rabbi Yechiel Mipariz's son-in-law, the author of the Sefer Mitzvot Katan, Rabbi Yitzchak of Korbei. We have Piskei Rabbi Yitzchak Mikorbei in several manuscripts, and people have published them. Now we found recently three manuscripts. I mentioned here a New York manuscript. It's at the Jewish Theological Seminary, the original. And there's a Paris version, and there's a Cambridge version. And the three are sort of similar but not identical, which also happens sometimes. They're copied differently, more or less. And in this case, this is not so much about halacha, but look what you can learn about their yeshivas, about how they learned. We'd love to learn about how the Balei HaTosas learned. They hardly tell us. They were too busy learning. Somebody named Moritz Moshe Gideman wrote a wonderful book in the late 1800s, around 1895. HaTorah HaChayim is the Hebrew translation from the German, which I won't even begin to bother you with. It's a great title anyway. You can try and break your teeth on it. But anyway, he writes, the Balei HaTosas learned so much and barely tells anything about how they learned, where they learned, you know, the conditions. So look here, I just picked out three from a collection from this New York manuscript, from this JTS manuscript. These are students of Rabbeinu Peretz. Peretz ben Eliyahu of Korbei, same town as the Smak, dies around 1298. And my point here is you can find these lost things throughout the period of Balei HaTosas. They're all over the place. Right? Three little time about Rabbeinu Peretz and his students. Right? Rabbeinu Peretz is the not the author, but he's the compiler. He's the coordinator of what we call Tosas Rabbeinu Peretz. He started to put them together around 1260. When he died in 1298, his students continued. So, very important to us. We'd like to know who the students are. So look what he says. He says three things that I gave you quickly. He says, Ode Mikvod Maloso, probably. That's another from our Rebbe, from our honored Rebbe. She'ishta harabonis. That his wife, the Rebbetzin, when she took challah from the dough that she fed them, she let them know, right? She let them know. Why? Vinira. Why she let them know? Like she said, I'm taking challah now on behalf of you, okay? Why? Vinira shata mishun torim shalom midas. Because there's an issue that when somebody, I can take truma for you, but you have to know. So she gives them a modah, you know, I'm taking the truma. So what do you learn from here? The Rebbetzin was a baker, fine. No, what you learn from here is, are the Bachrim, do they live in the Rebbe's house? So somebody named Kanerfogel said yes many years ago on base of all kinds of proofs. Sign this up, I didn't know this one then, right? Basically, the yeshiva's Balei HaTosas may not have been any bigger than whoever the Rebbe could feed and sleep in his house or maybe in the neighborhood. They're little groups, right? Basically, the yeshiva was all eating the Rebbetzin's food. In other words, and that's also an interesting question. Who paid for it? Did they pay? Also interesting questions. Look at the next one. The next one, in some ways, actually, go to the one on the immediate left first, because the one on top is the most unusual. The old, right? Mikvod Maloso, right? Shemazhir le'echad mi'bachurov. He used to warn one of his bachrim. Lomar tchinos lipo aponu b'veis ha'knesset she'in ba'oron ha'kodesh. Interesting problem, and many people in America don't do this, and many people in Israel do this. It's a machlokas rishon or machron. Can you fall tachlon when there's no sefer Torah? Whole question, right? The fields are fine. If they sefer Torah, so he told the bachrim, right? If you're davening, what does it mean a base knesset without aron kodesh? Meaning wherever you're davening, if there's no aron kodesh, you can still fall tachlon. Again, suggesting that they davened right there, right? Okay, good. The top one is in some ways the most interesting. Od mikvod malasu bachurim shaloshim palas kotchelam betchilas shavua ve'enam poshtem eliam kol shavua she'ein tzarech lahasir ha'palas levorach. So you'll say, oh, here's how we learn about not good hygiene for yeshiva bachurim. They wore the tzitzis the whole week and they didn't take it off. So first of all, medieval Europe is not, it's cooler than here. But also the hygiene is different, right? There were no daily showers, right? So that's a whole interesting problem. That's the whole problem of whether it's during the 9 days or whether it's during Yom Tovim and so on. Is it an istinus and how? And posts can deal with it very, very seriously for men, for women, and so on and so forth, right? They didn't have those problems. But what you have here is not, so let's not talk about the hygiene part, but here's the interesting thing. There's a passage in the Smag, the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, which seems to suggest that the yeshiva bachurim didn't untie the yeshiva. They didn't take their clothes off a whole week until they went to take a shower for Shabbos or something, to wash for Shabbos. The whole week they basically loosened their shoes, but they didn't take them off. So the question was, is that real or is that just some kind of, hagiography here, especially since there's a Gemara which seems to say something like that. You should learn it. No, you shouldn't get undressed. Just keep learning. You know, take a Dremel. Don't sleep till Shabbos. All kinds of stories about yeshivas in Europe where they didn't sleep too much. Okay, but people thought maybe it's just some kind of a nice way to say it. Here it seems that the Bachurim didn't get undressed during the week. In other words, they kept the tzitzis on the gansavach. Again, forget that we change our clothing every day. Again, don't worry about the hygiene. But somebody, a medievalist once wrote that the odor of the medieval towns for people today, it's all what you're used to. You know, today, if somebody, didn't do such a good job, people, oops. You always worry in the elevator. But in medieval towns, they didn't worry. In other words, it was, it was what it was. And again, if you're used to used. So forget that part. But here we have, again, confirmation of the Bachurim literally sleeping in their clothes, at least during the week. Right? So again, all in Piskei Rabbeinu Peretz. So that's what's interesting here. This is dafka not. I mean, there are halachic issues here, right? There's the challah issue, there's the tachanun issue, there's even the clothing issue, the brachas issue. In other words, if you don't take your tzitzis off, you don't make a new bracha. Right? That's an interesting question. What about Shavuos night? So, taka. What they tell the young men, non-married men or people who wear talis Shavuos night, they tell them, hear the bracha from a married person, a person who wears a talis makes a bracha, is allowed to make a bracha because he put in the talis on new, he didn't sit in the whole night. And the people who are wearing tzitzis the whole night should just shake their tzitzis, they should activate the tzitzis, right? At least, and be yotze with the bracha. So that's really say it's the shayla. So the shayla, so that's what I'm talking about, even slice of life things. In other words, social historians could learn a lot here too. Forget lomdus and all of that. Anyway. And finally, what in some respect is my favorite, especially since this one I found myself, till now we've been talking mostly about lost Sifrei Halacha, and some very weighty halachas, and court records, and longness, and svara. And again, it's interesting to what extent some later Rishonim preserve some of these things, some Achronim were aware of it, and you get these kind of little snippets, but until you start to try to put it together, you don't really know what you're missing here. So now we know a little bit what we're missing. This, number five, is in a completely different area. It's not in halacha, it's in chumash. Number five is an example, and actually I'm very pleased, I just got the galleys for the book that has this. I know what page this is on in the book. Anyway, so Baruch Hashem, I got to daven over it so we can get it out. But there are a whole series of Balei Hatosis, real ones, who wrote great stuff on chumash that we have no idea. We know Rashi, Baruch Hashem, many Kisveya, and he's the star. That's why there are so many, because Rashi's the star. If you got Rashi, that's if you have to pick one, pick Rashi. We have Rashbam, who's a great Baal HaTosfos and learning also in Gemara too. Although from Rashbam, we have exactly 1.5 manuscripts, 1.25. Interesting. Rashi, there are hundreds. Rashbam, one. We have Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, who's a Baal HaTosfos, Rabbi Yosef of Orleans. Okay. But it turns out, and some of you know this from me, there are several, more than one and more than two, leading Balei Hatosfos, whom we don't know so well, but who we know are real. This Rabbi Yom Tov of Zhuani, as we'll see in a minute, was a student of Rabbeinu Tam. Right, as I mentioned, he's called Rab Tetav, Tosfos Yom Tov. You have like a nickname, a moniker, a handle, right? He's a Talmud and learning of Rabbeinu Tam. So you have in three Kisveyad, and there are more, but three Kisveyad, between the three of them, 80, 90 comments on Chumash from Rabbi Yom Tov of Zhuani. Can I prove to you he wrote a sefer? No, but 80, 90 comments is not just, the weekly newsletter. In other words, that means that something is going on here, and it may be there are other manuscripts that have more comments. In other words, what somebody needs to do now is really go through everything and go posuk by posuk. But I in this book I put out about 60, 70 comments, in other words, to try to analyze what. And I'll read you one. Let's read one together, and you'll see. Very clever. It's even pshat-like. It's not just, nothing wrong with Medrash, but it's not just Medrashim. We're putting together Chazals, right? What I mention here is, it's on the Pasuk of Yosef, Hu ha-shalit al ha-aretz, Hu ha-mashpil chol am ha-aretz. I'll tell you what the problem is in a second, in Breishis. It's in a work that we have called Paneach Roza, which is a collection of Balei HaTosfos on Chumash, but not in the printed one. This is from a Munich manuscript, Caveat Minchin. The three manuscripts that I used productively were a Munich manuscript, a British Museum, which people knew about but didn't know what was in it, a British Museum manuscript, which people didn't realize what was in it, and a St. Petersburg manuscript that only showed up a few years ago because of Glasnost. They only got pictures of it, so nobody knew that even existed. So you put those three together, and some of them confirm, and some of them are the same comments, but you get a whole bunch of comments. So let's take a look here. This is coming right out of Ketavia. This is from my typing. There may be some typos, but I hope not. The problem is, Vayavo b'nei Yisrael ishbor b'sol chaboim, right? Uchsiv basrei v'yosef hu hashalit v'hu hamashbir, right? The sons of Yaakov, b'nei Yisrael, literally the sons of Israel, the sons of Yaakov came to acquire food amongst the others who came along, right? It's a funny way of saying it, right? Lishbor b'sol chaboim. You know, they were part of the crowd. Why does it say they're part of the crowd? And it says afterwards that Yosef is the ruler and he is the mashbir. He's the provider, right? He's the feeder. That's the story of Israel, the mashbir, right? Got everything you need. Mashbir latzarchan. Whatever you need, they got, right? So, again, it's a funny series of psukim. What does it mean? They came with everybody else? No, they came by themselves. I mean, who cares? And secondly, why does the Torah have to say that Yosef is the ruler and the provider? And here, the Hikshah HaRab Yom Tov, here not with his Tetav handle, just with his name. Rab Yom Tov Mizrani, by the way, as you see here, dies in 1190. He was actually killed in York, England in a pogrom in 1190. Rabbeinu Tam's Rebbe dies in 1171. We know who he is. He's mentioned in Tosfos not infrequently. You know, not every page, but not infrequently. We know who Rab Yom Tov is. Hikshah HaRab Yom Tov, Uma Bazel HaShmienu, Hacha, Shi Yosef Hu HaShalit. The basic Kasha is, what is the Torah telling us? That Yosef is the ruler. Well, both. The Chieni Odeshu Amashbir, right? If you tell me he's the ruler, he's also the provider. It's like telling you he's the general, he's also a colonel. Right? He's the head of the country, he's also the head of the food. Not so clever. Elohachi Piresh Rabbi Yom Tov Mijiwani. That's Yivani is Jiwani. J-O-I-G-N-Y. It's a little town in northern France. Hach Piresh Yosh Mijiwani. V'yesh Lomar here. So he answered his own question. That this is linked up to the problem of they came along with everybody who was coming in. Oh, so now he tells you a story, which is almost intrigue filled. Some of you may have heard this before, but it's a great story, right? It's almost intrigue filled. Pirish, habalish bort fuwa me Yosef kedei laharviachba ulamachro laachayrim bedam yikarim. Oh, that there were besoch habaim, there were people who were going to make business on this. What were they going to do? They were going to buy the tavua from Yosef, and what would they do? Buy low, sell high. They'll then provide a service. We'll be the middlemen, and we'll buy and sell it to others, right? At a higher price, obviously, right? In other words, so that's besol haboin. So people trying to make business, even in famine, you got to make business, right? You know, even in war, God forbid, people make business, right? They got to sell the stuff for the war. So here there were people who are coming in. What do you mean they're coming in? They're coming in to make a killing, right? Pirish habolish bort fuami osik hil ar viachba. They'll then sell it for higher. Ulamachul achayr bedar miyakar. By selling it to others at higher prices. Va'achay Yosef. So that was what was going on. That was the situation. There were these middlemen. So the brothers of Yosef amru niknemin haba'im liknos tfuahu b'mitzrayim lo navo. They said, you know what? Not that they wanted to waste their money. They said, that's a good idea. We're going to buy from these middlemen. Why? Because the middlemen didn't stand in the corner in Egypt. They took the things they bought from Yosef, and they went to this corner, to that country, to this place, to that place. We can buy the food, what, near Mitzrayim without having to go into Mitzrayim. Why is that a good idea? Obviously, Shema Yivka Bana Yosef, Shinim Karla Mitzrayim. Because if we don't go near Mitzrayim, the chances of us meeting Yosef are slim to none. If we don't into Mitzrayim, who knows, maybe we'll bump into Yosef. So, in this case, the Jews were going to pay a high price, premium. Why? Delivery, home delivery. If we get home delivery, or, you know, just go one town over, or wherever it is, we don't have to get involved in Mitzrayim. We won't risk seeing Yosef. Pretty clever, right? So this is, again, a pshat tactic of what's the scene behind the psukim. So the scene is this whole cat and mouse game, right? So the brothers look pretty smart. And the businessmen are doing what they do naturally. Wait till you see how smart Yosef is here, right? Shema Yifka Bani Yosef, Shem comes from V'yikbo Aleinu. He'll complain. You know, he'll turn us in, right? Kaval. He'll kvetch. Sheganavnu also, umasanu also. Who knows? Yosef could put us in jail. You know, he's in Mitzrayim. Maybe he'll call the, you know, he'll call the FBI. They'll arrest us, right, for our past crimes. V'yoser tov sh'nitein le'elo haba'im l'knos tfuat tadir v'ma'at revach. Better we should give our money to those who are buying the stuff regularly, even though they're making a profit, you know. Pach and katana, they don't want to waste their money, but that's a good price, a good thing. V'lo nitztarech l'vol Mitzrayim. Right, so again, the brothers look clever, and we have an understanding of what the ba'im are. There's this food chain, there's this food flow, right? So we won't go to the end of the stop, we'll buy it in the middle. We'll buy it from the middleman. V'hirgi Yosef batavar. But, brothers were smart, Yosef was smarter. He figured it out, he sensed it. V'omar, and he said, oh, Yosef knew there were middlemen, right? Okay, so, you know, in terms of Yosef has nothing against the middlemen per se. People are getting their food. Some have more money, they can pay more. Okay, he's not against it personally, but he said, Shema yiknu echav min haba'im heino. My brothers are not stupid. They may not be nice, but they're not stupid, right? And therefore, they're going to think what I'm thinking. They're going to say, let's use the middlemen. Letziva laba'im achar hatfua, and therefore he made a rule that those who are coming in, the comer-innerers, the middlemen, shelo yikne Yosef michtei tzorcham. One food ration for everybody. Rationing. He put in a rationing system. You can come in and buy, but how much can you buy for? Yourself. You can't hoard. You can't, no resale. Right? Velo yimkeru l'acherim. So you have no chance. So he basically busted up this middleman purveyor system. V'tzival l'chol over v'shav shelo yikne elem imenu. And he further, and he made it, and the other way, he also made a rule, as he told the middlemen, no more middlemaning, you get one. And he told the consumers, asur liknot from the middlemen. You know, we're busting up the whole system. He put out a new rule. V'az bal korchem yavol l'sham achei Yosef. Why? Because Yosef needed them to come down to Mitzrayim. So now, they would have to come to him. And he did all the selling himself. Basically, it's a central distribution center that he was in charge of, right? Utsrichim liknos mimenu. Not only have to show up in Mitzrayim, there's only one address for the food. Yosef's warehouse. Right? Ubezeh mashmakan shi Yosef hu hashalit vuhu hamashmir. So that's what the pasuk means. Yosef is the ruler, and therefore he's the provider. Why? Because that was his chokhmah. He said, I'm in charge here. I will provide. No one else will provide. So the double usage here is very, very clear and very well understood. Ki ba'atzmo haya moser l'chulam. He was the king and he was the cook, because he wanted everybody to have to come to him for the food. Solve all your pshat problems here. Who are the ba'im? We now understand. Solve mashbir and shalit problems, and you get a very nice story behind the psukim. Right? Who knew this stuff? When I saw this in the manuscript, I said, whoa. Spot typing. Right? Again, we had no idea. You know, I could say that I went looking for it, which I did to some extent, but you fall on it. It falls on you. Again, you know, we'll share more of these things as these things come out. You have a whole series of fantastically creative, you know, so whether it's Rashi Pshat or Rashbam Pshat or Lobadiuk Pshat, it's very, I mean, these are Rishonim. Very clever, very creative. Who would have thought, who would have thunk that story up? You need to be pretty smart. You need to be a Rishon. Right? And Taminuli, there are tens of these things. There are just, you know, plenty of them. Again, not lost in the sense that we can't go looking, but there is no book. In other words, as I say, if somebody produces 80, 90, 120 comments, they must have wrote a little bich or something. There must be a, you know, a perush, you know, a perush. Maybe not every pasuk, but nope. Not yet. I'll let you know. But so these are also, so, you know, that's an important point to conclude. I'll make one final point. You can find these things not only in halacha, and not only in, you know, big burning issues, but even as we saw on the rabbinic side, in smaller issues, you can find it in the Parshanut HaMikra, you can find it in other areas. Right? You know, years ago, I started to find all kinds of involvement of Balei HaTosis and Torah HaSo. The difference there is, it's hard to find books. Right? It seemed to be, you know, sort of like a hobby. Here already you find more substantive compositions. Final comment, and I'll happily take your questions. So the interesting question, especially in the halachic stuff, is, so what do? We find this stuff. What happens if we find stuff that changes the halacha, or that, you know, it could impact the halacha? So here we know, there was a very interesting exchange in Tradition magazine, I think in the early 1980s, between Professor Lyman and Lyman Gesundheit, coming here to teach next semester. We have a special program. He's coming along. I got him. Very excited. He was on my doctoral committee. We had my teacher. Terrific. Anyway, between Professor Lyman and another somebody who had learned with the Chazon Ish about the Chazon Ish's approach. And the other person argued the Chazon Ish, if they showed him manuscripts, he got, no, you know, not Chodesh Asim in HaTorah, but if it's not in the Svarim, and Professor Lyman showed it's not true. He was concerned if you have something in a manuscript that purports to be a Rishon's view, how do you know? So he threw a couple of pieces in Masachas Pesachim where they showed him things in what's called Otsah HaGeonim, Geonic material that had been found and produced, and he said, oh, that sounds like the Geonim. You know, in other words, so the question is, how do you identify it? So that's one issue. The issue is, what's the level of certainty, and how do you know? The next issue then becomes, if it's a halachic source that Rishonim and Achronim didn't have, well, let's say the Rishonim had it, it got lost. To what extent can you reintroduce that into the halachic system? And here Achropos can talk about it. Right? It's interesting, about the Or Zeruah itself, I don't remember exactly where, I have to go look for both of them, but both the Mishnah Berurah, who died in 1933, and the Orach HaShulchan, who died in 1918, both say at one point in Hilchos Shabbos, the Or Zeruah, remember, was published in Jutamir in 1862, so it wasn't, you know, put out online, you couldn't just get it. They both say at one point in Hilchos Shabbos, they were writing in the late 19th century, you know, oh, we just got an Or Zeruah, he solves a problem here in Hilchos Shabbos. So you can make use, you just have to know, right, is it authentic? And there are rules that the poskim have. Again, there is this notion that if a source didn't go through what I would call, sort of, it's not my phrase, but the kur hamivchon of psak, if it wasn't tested, you know, you can't just throw in shittas, new. But first of all, you might get a fuller understanding, and you might be able to use that. So, you know, what's found in this kind of way, in these lost svarim, may not necessarily change the face of modern halacha, but there is usability, and more importantly, in learning, it's all fair. In other words, the moment we know that this material is coming from these Rishonim, in terms of lomdus, in terms of thinking about what the Gemara means, in terms of interpreting the Pesukim, in terms of understanding more deeply the issues, this is all free and clear. Right? In other words, we're not necessarily going to change every Pesach halacha, but in terms of adding to what we know in Torah, these things can be critically important. Critically important. So that's a little story about what's lost, and I'm glad you found the place here because they put us in the wrong room. We got the lost room, the lost books, anyway. But and I'm happy to answer any questions you have them. I probably completely flummoxed you here, which I didn't mean to do. But anyway, this is just a little, this is what we call in Hebrew, Ktzeh HaMazleg, the tip of the iceberg, right? The Hebrew idiom is Ktzeh HaMazleg. Not too many people know icebergs, but anyway. You know, Titanic, it's not a good imagery. So Ktzeh HaMazleg, this is just the beginning, really, of this type of thing. Okay, anyway, Hatzlacha on your week here of Svarim, right? Tomorrow's one more night, you have one more night? Okay, good, okay. And Thursday night is, everybody gotta go home. Oh, Mishmar, even better. Even better. Okay, then you find this farm and use it. Good. All right, ladies, thank you. And again, we can talk now, later. It's all yours. Okay. Yes? Good. My pleasure. My pleasure. Okay.